I want this afternoon to try to present some of the main motifs in the Jungian interpretation of these matters that we've been dealing with. This seems to me to be the most useful of the modern depth psychology readings for the interpretation of mythology. The Jungian psychology takes off from Freud and Adler. As Jung points out in his two essays in Individual Psychology, it's quite possible to interpret neurotic problems in terms either of the Freudian sexual or in terms of the Adlerian power system. And then he points out that actually these represent two aspects of everybody's psychological orientation. Now, I don't think I have to go through the elementary introduction to Freudian psychoanalysis for a group like this. Basically, one can say that for Freud, there is the immediate crisis after birth, you might say, of a wish or an impulse and the prohibition brought against that by the mother or father or disciplinary agent. And these prohibitions against which the wish comes are functions of the social order. They are determined by the society in which the individual exists. The parent in one society will say yes to something which in another society would receive a no. Consequently, the parent becomes the agent for the social structure, and the wish, which cannot be fulfilled, since an infant cannot sustain a tension of unfulfillment, is, as he says, pushed into the unconscious. With the wish, however, goes the prohibition, and that's the great Freudian formula: wish, prohibition. The wish then goes into the unconscious, and along with it the prohibition, so that you have a plus-minus quantum down there, and it's that tension. Every time that wish recurs from the unconscious, it carries with it the prohibition, which has been, as Freud says, introjected. It has become an operating factor in the psychological structure of this individual. Now, such an electric charge cannot be retained. It has to be projected, and it is projected on apparently innocent phenomena, and so you get the projection of the forbidden wish on some apparently innocent object, which immediately becomes infected with mana, with unrealistic energy, energy that has no relationship to that object's actual value in life. But the object becomes then, as it were, a sacred object, radiant in a certain way, and the person's relationship to it is ambivalent and in tension. Now, for Freud, these wishes are largely related to the parent. The parental images become the agents of the social system. One prohibition after another going down into the unconscious builds up what is called by religious people the conscience. And conscience is simply the interjected social taboo system. Then Freud speaks of three great stages in the genetic development of the individual psyche. The first, that of infancy, and the second, that of the period from about 5 years old to about 11, which he calls the period of latency, little boy, little girlhood, and then finally comes this crisis of puberty. In the first period, there are a number of particular traumatic moments, and I'm not going to go through these, the birth trauma, and then the business of the relationship to the mother breast, and then the business of defecation and all the interest associated with that, and then the discovery or experience of the import of the male-female relationship, and then the establishment of the Oedipus complex, which is complete by the age of 5. Then comes a period of latency, which is a period of ego testing. That is to say, the erotic factor falls into second place, and the aggressive element comes in. I once had the pleasure of teaching in a boys' prep school, and the spectacle of aggression in various manifestations was just a bit too much. Then, at the period of puberty, comes the erotic back into force again, running, however, in the old channels. By this time, the relationship to the mother is no longer oral. The main center of erotic experience has shifted to the genital zone, and at that time, it's not proper, really, to have the same set of feelings to the mother as formerly. In fact, it's biologically and every other way improper. And a person who has not been able to graduate over these two thresholds remains fixated to them, so that in adult life, the member of the opposite sex always echoes father or mother images, and the attitudes established in childhood, which are improper to the present period, become occasions for great neurotic concern and agitation. In Freud, one has the feeling that if one can establish a decent marriage relationship and after puberty, in the early stages of youth, that's about all the problems you have, and you're set. He actually says to certain of his, well, there is a paper in which he was writing for a young psychiatrist, after the age of 35, there's no point in trying to psychoanalyze anybody. You have to take him too much apart, and so he'd be lying all over the floor like a dismembered automobile. And Freud is counting on the present energy to reconstruct the parts which he takes apart, and if that energy isn't there, all you've got is a dismembered organism. On the other hand, for Jung, it is precisely the crises after 35 that are most interesting. When you come to Adler, the first heretic in the Freudian school of dogma, it is not this sex or erotic principle that is regarded as the dominant, but the will to power. And as he points out, the obstacle that the infant meets is not so much the prohibition of the parent as his own puny impotence to realize what he wants. And so that same thing of wish and failure to realize it is translated into a power failure instead of a collision with a parental image. Now, if the parents are not helpful to the child and tend to keep him in the situation of inability to realize what he wants, you get an excessive sense of impotence, which leads to a counter intention, which he calls overcompensation. This is the inferiority complex, a compulsion throughout life to prove oneself because one has been given the sense in early life that one is unable to do what one wants to do. And then every field of endeavor, no matter what it is, sex or anything else, becomes a field for testing and proving oneself. So the one's continually saying, how am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? Now, from Jung's standpoint, the psychological energy shows itself in both directions. And a person who has been frustrated excessively will then be pitched excessively strongly in this area of concern, and the actual ability to experience the delights of the various modes of love for the world and nature and everything else will be in suppression, so to say. A person who is oriented primarily to the power complex, Jung calls an introvert. That's his primary sense for the word introversion. He is always asking, how am I doing? And in this sense, the introvert may be a very outgoing person, apparently, but he's active in the outer field only to prove himself. This, in the Kundalini system that I was talking about the other day, is the attitude of the third chakra, the power chakra, Manipura. A person on this side, on the other hand, is what Freud calls an extrovert. He is open to the impact of experience. He is not always pulling it into his system of determinations. He is open to it. People who find that they cannot experience the warmth and love of the world for them are very often introverts who want it to come to them in a certain way. They are trying to control what the world is going to give them. That is the introvert. And he has his own special way of being unhappy. The extrovert is altogether open, completely so. And of course, he may end up by getting nowhere. So he has his way of being unhappy too. Now, in the Jungian view, person becomes, as a result perhaps of this, that, or the other thing, committed to one or the other of these attitudes in early life, and his development of his life follows the force of that course. Now let's suppose he is a power person, and he becomes infected with the idea to achieve a certain achievement. There will come a moment in life, a point in his life, when he will have achieved it, or pretty nearly have achieved it, or realized it was unachievable and sort of given up. Then he has what Jung calls disposable libido. Or again, he is still working to achieve, but it is becoming easier and easier and easier. He doesn't have to work so hard. He has disposable libido. So what's he going to do with his disposable libido? Well, he doesn't determine that. The disposable libido determines that. And what it does is go over here and begin to activate his erotic system, which, however, has not been developed. The last thing he was in love with was fishing when he was a little boy. That was his last experience of, sensual delight and just the vivid world one way or another. Or daddy's eyes begin to twinkle when he sees the younger set moving around. He thinks, oh dear, I missed it all because I was so busy building all those buildings. And then the family says, what's going on with daddy? Now this is no joke because it's compulsive. He can't help it. Well, what's he going to do with this energy that's going to wreck his career, chasing the little girls around? He can let it go and let the career be a wreck and then become, start all over again, as Faust did. Only not many people have a Mephistopheles to bring them to the witch's kitchen to rejuvenate their youth, and so one is afflicted with this agony too late. So you're the sugar daddy for somebody, but it really is too late and the whole thing is unsatisfactory and the nervous breakdown comes along. Or daddy may say to himself, no, and become harder and harder in his resistance to all this and very, very ungenerous in his thoughts about people who are enjoying that part of the world. In which case, one third of his energy is going toward the little girls, another third is stopping him, and there's only one third left, and things go to pieces anyhow. So there's one way or another of cracking up here. Let's take the other side. Mother. She's given her whole life to the outer world. Her whole world is out there, not in here at all. And then at a certain age, the little fledglings begin to be fledged, and the house gets to be emptier and emptier. And where is her life? Besides, the children start saying very nasty things about her and correcting her. She can't do anything right. And they don't want her anymore, and she's becoming more and more of a nuisance because the compulsion to control is taking over. To hold it to herself, this thing is going away, and she becomes what's known as a mother-in-law. So that at a certain stage in life, there is this inevitable problem. It's not the conflict, in Jung's terms, between ineptitude and the will to win, a result of infantile situations. It's not a hangover of my wish versus my parent, the Oedipus complex. It's an inevitable recurrence of the need to balance these two sides, which are in everybody, these two powers, the erotic and the power drive, the second and third chakras of the Kundalini system, which I was talking about, are there. They can't be wiped out. They have to be brought together. Now, if a person has lived 60% of his energy over here as an introvert, the extrovert factor is 40%. That's not too bad. Here's a person who can play in both worlds, has a fairly decent family life and a fairly decent success life. But if it has been overplayed in either direction, there is going to be a real crisis, possibly one that cannot be resolved at all, when the breakthrough comes. Now, Jung's term for this shift over, and it's always nice to have a big term for the things that are going to happen to you, is enantiodromia. That's a good one. And this is from Heraclitus, enantiodromia. Dromia means running. A dromedary is a racing camel. A hippodrome is a place where hippos, namely horses, run. Enantio in the other. Running in the other way, tipping over. Now, there are minor moments of enantiodromia long before the big crisis comes. Your attitude is all based on your own presentation of yourself and your prestige and so forth, and then you come into a place where nobody appreciates you. You get sulky. The other person comes up from within. The side that is inferior is uncontrollable, is compulsive. A civilized human being is in control of his faculties. A barbarian is not. The function then of the second half of life for Jung is that of integrating these two. And this is the first point of what he calls the integration of the personality. Integration. And this is a problem that all of us face all the time. Life requires of us the movement in one or the other of these directions, and yet you have to cultivate the opposite. So much then for the first point about Jung. He has shifted back one stage the definition of the libido, the driving psychological energy. For Freud, it was a sex drive, essentially. For Adler, a power drive. For Jung, it is an energy that operates in both directions, and necessarily so. And so we have for Jung the second and third chakras in operation, not simply one or the other. Now we come to something else. Jung speaks of the four psychological functions. This is a very important point in his psychology. These four functions are to be classified in two pairs. One pair of functions that have to do with receiving experience. The other pair has to do with evaluating the experience. The evaluating functions, the functions by which you evaluate experience and determine your response, are thinking and feeling. True, false, good, evil, that sort of thing. Shallow, deep, rich, thin, gratifying, repulsive. These are contrary to each other. They're totally different orders of judgment. In Jung's experience, the men, in the Western world at any rate, tend to favor the thinking function in the determination of their life judgments. The women tend to favor the feeling judgment. Thinking of an inferior sort is opinion. Opinion is thought governed by feeling judgment. And in order to change the opinion, you have to transform the feeling, not the thing up here. Inferior feeling is sentimentality. Sentimentality is feeling based on thoughts. And you can see this immediately in art, where art based on concepts, justice, then what are you going to do with that? You can become sentimental about these things. People whose feelings are undeveloped are sentimentalists. People whose thinking is undeveloped are opinionated. The next two functions have to do with the reception of the experience, which is to be evaluated. And these two are sensation, or sensation, and intuition. Now, intuition is specifically defined by Jung to mean the experiencing of life in a certain way. Sensation has to do with the five senses. What the five senses are in touch with is what is right here spatially. Intuition has to do with the catching, as the phenomenon comes, of its direction in time. What brings it about, what its aim is, where it's going, what it's going to take you to. Also, it is the recognition immediately of invisible relationships. This is the prime function for pedagogy and politics. Politics is the art of knowing what is possible and getting it like that, not thinking it out from collecting statistics and asking a statistician something or other. By that time it's too late. The one with the intuition has the ball. The sensation then, the person of sensation is oriented to space. The person essentially intuitive is missing that and catching future possibilities, past import, and all that sort of thing. What I want to point out is that every one of us is operating on two of these functions primarily. One by which we receive experience, another by which we judge experience, and the opposite functions will be inferior. Jung speaks of superior and inferior functions. They go into the unconscious, and the inferior functions in the unconscious tend to contaminate each other. Now let us look at the norms in our contemporary world. Our world is primarily oriented to the sensation-thinking functions in its sciences. There are two kinds of logic. One which gathers experience and then judges on the basis of thinking about it. This is inductive logic. Another thinks out some things and then goes to prove it and demonstrate it. That is deductive logic. And these are the favored functions for the male in our society. And then we attribute to the female the opposites. She is a person of feeling, she's a person of intuition. Whereas in the male, the feeling and intuition functions have been violently, very often, suppressed. In the arts, you can have the artist who reads sensation into feeling, a kind of impressionist, the feeling into sensation, sort of expressionist, and then you have the non-objective modes of intuition in one direction or another. A philosopher whose function is rather intuition than sensation is terribly difficult to classify. And here you have Nietzsche, for example, who speaks of himself as a dancing philosopher. He keeps shifting ground, and what he calls perspectivism is his main line. And it's a very different kind of philosophy from that, let's say, of Bertrand Russell. These four functions, then, are operating in all of us, two always in the inferior zone. Now we are going to be either extrovert or introvert. If we are introvert sensation thinking, our feeling and intuition will be in extrovert mode, and vice versa, and so forth and so on. See, Jung's picture is getting to be a bit complicated. We have introvert now, extrovert, and then the four functions. A fully functioning, integrated individual is able to intuit when intuition is in order, to feel when it's time to feel, and to think when it's time to think. That is to say, all of his functions are adequately available. Now we come to the final point, and now we're approaching the theme of the archetypes of Jung. I want to draw a picture of the soul as Jung would describe it. Following Plato, the soul is a circle, so let's draw a circle. Now every circle has a center, so let's put a center there. However, as we know, we have a consciousness and an unconsciousness, and the center is below the threshold of consciousness. The center of consciousness, Jung calls ego. Ego, in relation to ourselves, is what we know of ourselves, what we identify as ourselves. Ego has a door open to the environment. Ego can see what is out there, the empirical reality outside. Ego is that psychological function which puts us in touch with empirical actuality and with the actuality about ourselves. It may, however, be imperfectly informed. It can be in error, but its potentiality is to be correct in its knowledge. That aspect of ourselves which ego refuses to admit, which is there, experiences that are rejected, Jung calls the shadow. The shadow is, to put it in a very succinct form, the Freudian unconscious. It is the result of our biography. It is biographically determined. But that there should be a shadow is inevitable. Every one of us has a shadow. The shadow, this is one of Jung's archetypes, is of the same sex as the ego. It is that aspect of your actual existence, your actual potentialities, your actual life experience, which has been repressed. Those traumatic scars and so forth that Freud talks about. Ego and shadow. The center and circumference, that is to say, the true bounding and centering of your actual personality and potentiality, Jung calls the self. Now he makes a great point of the distinction between his concept of the self,
which is that a functioning biological creature. And the Hindu term Atman, which is generally translated self, which however refers to an anonymous spiritual principle, that which I spoke of earlier, which cannot be named, cannot be categorized, is beyond all classification, categorization, and so forth. The Indian aim in yoga to break through, to say, so to say, to break past out of this, to be released from this, and pitch oneself into the Atman, is as though the whole energy of the body were drained out into the source ocean from which all energy comes. That is not Jung's aim. He has nothing to do with that when he's going to be talking about individuation and all that sort of thing. So there's point one in cutting Jung away from Orientalism. He is accused of being a mystic. There's nothing mystical about anything I've been talking about so far. And there's nothing mystical about finding the harmony of your own system in the sense of mysticism as the attempt to unite yourself with the all. I see a hand up. Now, next, and now I come to something a little bit difficult sometimes to present or to grasp. You face the world. The ego faces an environment through the protection of a society. The society offers you, the society in which you live, offers you certain roles to play. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, what are you going to be, Jimmy? These roles, these parts to play, these garments to wear, Jung calls personae. The persona is the mask worn by a Roman actor. It is the mask worn by an actor. This mask includes the moral system of the society. Not only the role, but also the moral implications of the role. One of the psychological calamities of any life, from Jung's standpoint, is to identify ego with persona. When the ego becomes identified with the persona, you become a stuffed shirt. You are simply enacting a role. There is nobody there. I want to point out that, as I showed this morning, this is exactly the aim of Oriental education, that you should become identified with the persona. Whereas the Jungian aim of what he calls individuation is to keep that separate. Now, that's not too easy. Because when mother says, do this and don't do that, a moral order is being presented to you. And your behavior, your character, your dress, everything else implies a certain role with which you identify. Jung's suggestion is that you put masks on and take them off according to the requirements of circumstance, because this whole thing has to do with existence in the world, how you exist there. When the persona is identified with ego and is then rejected, the ego itself then seeks another persona. It can't stand on its own feet. This then is what he calls the ethnic unconscious or ethnic consciousness, those virtues rejected by the society, those virtues or vices fall into the unconscious. There is a certain persona for the male, but he has sentiments that don't fit in those, in that mask. These he projects on the female. There are certain sentiments expected of the female, others rejected. The rejected one she projects onto the male. Furthermore, every one of us has within us a certain little seed germ, you might say, of the opposite sex. This is why we understand and meet and enjoy each other. We are each supplementing what is rudimentary in the other. The unconscious ideal of woman in the male, Jung calls the anima, that's the word for soul. The unconscious image of the male in the female, the unconscious ideal of the male in the female, he calls the animus. Now, the male image of the female, that is to say, the notion the male has of femininity, begins with his mother. This is the first being of his life. She is his nature world. And she remains the proper opposite. The female appreciation of the male begins only later, at a later age in life, 2, 3, 4 years old, depending on how precocious the little thing is. But by that time, her eyes are open to a number of males. There's her father, there's her brothers, there's her uncle, there's the doctor so-and-so, and all of that. So, as Jung says, a woman usually has a jury of animuses. And a woman, consequently, is far more flexible in her adjustment to different male images than the male is to adjustment to the female. Woman is always more ready for change and variety in moral judgments, in costume situations and all that. The male tends to be rather stuffy about these things. This then basically is the primary setup of the Jungian archetype system. There are some more coming along in a minute. We have the ego image, who in mythology is represented as the hero. We have the shadow, who in mythology is represented as that opposite, which is met at the threshold. We have the anima and animus of opposite sex, the luring one, the threatening one. And we have these various social masks of that square that I put up on the board this morning of the establishment. Now, for a while, everything's going fine. However, with this psychological setup, one can come up against an obstacle. There are a number of crises that may start everything moving. Let me suggest 3 or 4. First, there can take place what I've already mentioned, namely a relaxation of outer demands. Your job does not require as much of you as it did require, and you have disposable libido. It goes down into the unconscious and activates what's down there. What's down there is not only the shadow, but the undeveloped functions. Feeling, intuition, or thinking, sensation, whatever they may be. Also down there is the rejected attitude. Not if you're an introvert, your extrovert is down there. So this whole thing comes up as that which you are not, bang, threatening the ego. Just as, this is one then, relaxation of demands. Second, you may be older than you think. The whole psychology may have changed. Those things which are easy for youth are not so easy for later life, and vice versa. And yet we have, particularly in our culture, a kind of pathos of youth. Everybody wants to be young. Grandpa is trying to keep his golf score where it was when he was champion of the Harvard golf team, and is having all kinds of paroxysms of agony as a result of the way the score is creeping up. And Jung gives us an example of a crisis. A woman who is in her middle 40s, who is a spinster, and has been going fine on that tack, And then, like the little princess whose golden ball dropped into the pool, she loses all the joy in her life, and suddenly she feels on the rocks. The joy of life has gone. She's living in terms that are not proper to her present psychological state. So you can say a threshold passed and not recognized. I'm just going to put later than you think. A third kind of crisis one finds on campuses. Student comes from a certain home environment and is rooming with a student from a totally different home environment and finds that that student's perfectly all right too. Yet that student represents everything that the family has repudiated. And so the moral code, the persona code that has been holding this young person in style, in form, is cracked. The very first day in sociology class, in her freshman year, Professor Blitzbaum tells her that her father is a scoundrel, that the family fortune is built on blood and bones. And the kid comes home for the Thanksgiving dinner, and there's an explosion in the house. The father thinks, what kind of an education am I paying for? And the student has fallen away from father. What happens then normally is, and this is a kind of spectacle that one sees all over the place on campuses, the child identifies with the opposite. Tips over, there's an enantiodromia already, she has been swallowed by the whale. And she comes to class next time with her hair a mess and her clothing all different, and she's just changed. Now, she's nuts. She's no better off than she was before, because she has simply gone into opposite and rejected this. The goal of the Jungian analysis is not to go into opposite, it's to find the middle. Centroversion is the word. Well, how do you find the middle? One way is to go into the opposite. So, let's have this underwater excursion. Since every move now is the result of what Professor Blitzbaum told her, she isn't thinking at all. She is compelled. She's moving like a madwoman. And a campus, an institution, is a good place for somebody like that. It protects her against the number of bumps which she gets when she confronts the police and then is surprised. The institution, the campus, is a kind of sanctuary for this experiment in the abyss. She has become a mermaid down there in the water with a fishtail. So we have the loss of security in one's moral convictions. And this is a moral crack-up. The fourth that I want to speak of is the most moving and tragic. It is precisely the tragic crisis, namely the necessity to make an impossible decision between two absolutely impossible terms. One can think of a man who has fallen into deep poverty. He is a person who has been very righteous. I saw a good deal of this during the Depression when people were absolutely smashed. How can he both support his family and not steal, not become a criminal in his own life? You can't let your family die. You can't become a criminal. An impossible decision. Well, he makes a decision. That's the tragic decision. Or consider on a more imposing level the problem of Abraham, when God said, kill Isaac. That is a tragic summons, and that is the great thing about that moment. He makes his decision. Well, God saves him the result of it, but that's the cheating in the story, you might say. The most people don't have that luck. They have to do the thing that is intolerable. And when that has been done, an intolerable decision made, and you have to do the intolerable, your whole spiritual stance changes. It has been intolerable because it's unrealistic. Your moral code in the face of this circumstance is unrealistic. The main aim of life is to live, according to any judgment in these psychological terms. So there we have it. The situation changes and everything changes. The whole structure of the psyche changes. The opera begins. Now, when the persona structure begins to rattle and go loose, so does the animus structure. One begins to be fascinated by alien forms. The allure of the anima image or animus image that is not that standard of one's society becomes very imposing. It draws one out. This I call the twinkle twinkle temptation. The anima in this sense is always suggestive of evil, of sin. Come into the dark alley, little boy. The woman's image at this time is being ravished away by some demonic figure or something like that. On the other hand, if this isn't what is moving, but the shadow thing coming up, for instance, if a person has been devoted all his life to the extrovert attitude of life, the real threat is the power drive within, which is suppressed. And then this powerful shadow begins banging, and I always think of that as the knock-knock temptation. Who dat down there? you're just a frightened person of your own potentialities. I remember one charming little minister one time saying to me, if I did not believe in Christ and the salvation of the church, I would become a terrible person. I said, well, what do you think you'd do? And he named a couple of things. And I said, well, you get tired pretty soon. And furthermore, there'd just be one more philanderer added to the number, and who would care? You're not dangerous at all. And that relieved him a little bit. So these are the two first threats. The shadow, threatening from below, the anima or animus pulling you out from out there. And now it begins. Now the first stage of the process is that of going into opposite. As I've said, the student becomes a raving lunatic down here with all kinds of opinions about how to govern the universe, and doesn't yet know how to brush her teeth. And or the person comes down here infatuated with some very, very dangerous male or female who has all kinds of intentions, and the thing goes into movement. As I say, the first images are those of being ravished away. Jung describes the kind of imagery that comes up in dreams of this type at this moment. The emergence of demons threatening, the emergence of succuba and incubuses and all that sort of thing, being ravished away by charging horses, carried aloft by eagles, pulled down into the sea and so forth. You'll find these things in your dreams, the beginning of the integration. What we're trying to do is get everything pulled together here. I think of this often as comparable to driving a car. One drives in the left-hand drive, you see? And if you're not aware of the right-hand part of the car, you're driving from up here, and if you're not aware of what's down here, you're going to be taking fenders off and bumping into people and all that sort of thing. Well, is the way to solve the problem to get over here on the other drive and take them off over here? That's what happens when you go down into the unconscious. The thing you have to do is find out where the middle of the car is and drive with a parallax idea, judging the car. But you can't do that unless you know what's the other side of the car, and you have to go down there one way or other. The first figure to come into collision with the
individual is the shadow figure. Those aspects of your own masculinity or femininity, your own actuality, that you have not assimilated. This must be assimilated. So stage one is the assimilation of the rejected elements, aspects of one's own character. Jung calls this swallowing the frog. This is going through the narrow pass. This is that crisis that I mentioned in my hero cycle of this morning, when the hero comes to the threshold of adventure and meets the dark one, who is simply the other lost aspect of himself, the dark side of the moon. Next, the anima animus problem comes in. When this starts, one must not assimilate and identify. If you assimilate with your anima animus, there takes place a homosexual transformation. You tend to assume the inferior femininity or inferior masculinity of your own character. And a masculinized woman is not a very convincing man, and vice versa. Better to hold it and relate to that. You have to relate to this. What you are trying to find is the center, and there will be a guiding voice if you listen. Shadow first, to be assimilated. Anima animus as the guide to what Jung calls the archetypes of the unconscious. Those powers of the psyche with which you must not identify, but which you must recognize as operating in you. I had a very moving experience a couple of months ago when a young man came to me who thought he had been designated by God to take God's place. I saw him two or three times, and I won't say who or what his name was like or anything else, but he had these lovely eyes, and he was a Jewish boy. He had the hair, it was what the Germans call the Christusgesicht. He had cultivated the look of Christ, and there he sat telling me, the third time he saw me, "I know I was right with what I told you first. I have seen my father, I have talked with him, he is old now. And he tells me I must take over. I'm going to live for 2,000 years," and so forth and so on. What was wrong with that boy? The image in his heart was a good one. All he had done was identify himself with it and not let it operate in him. It was, to me, an appalling experience, because I realized that 2,000 years before I might have been looking at someone saying the same thing with exactly the same face. Well, sometimes you can get away with it. Sometimes. Finally, we come in the dream system to symbols of centering, becoming centered, and these Jung calls mandala symbols. That is a Sanskrit word meaning circle. And all of these mandalas tend to a center, to a fourfold division, with the self in the center, the four functions all functioning. That is to say, there is, in his idea, a correspondence between the psychological four and the four points of the compass. That is the form of a temple. That is what you see in every temple. The sanctuary in the center, the four points of the compass symbolized, the gates of entry and so forth. This is what is symbolized in the cross. This is what is symbolized in the swastika, which is simply the cross in motion. These forms begin to appear in the dream, and there will be characters set around in them. And there may be three elements, four elements, five elements, depending on how many of your functions and your relationship to them are in play. Your dreams, then, will start out with dreams of crisis, danger. Then there will take place a long series of what Jung calls the transitus, going back and forth. The thing about psychological transformation is it doesn't usually happen quickly. It's a long, slow ordeal. It can sometimes be two-thirds of a lifetime to get over one simple bump. But finally, it will happen, and you'll begin to have a sense of where your center is, what the center of judgment is, when feeling should work, when thinking should work. Your senses will be awake, your intuition's active, and you will begin to be what he calls an integrated personality. The problems of youth are not those of this integration. The problems of youth are those of relating to the persona system and maintaining a sense of distance from it, but you've got to operate in those terms. Otherwise, conk out. The problem of second half of life, when the roles that you've been living are dropping away, is to catch these powers that are beginning to push up and knock you apart from your own unconscious without identifying with them. So much then for a summary one-hour presentation of the basic psychology and archetypology of Jung. This figure in the center he calls the wise old man. This is the image that comes into people's mind with the guiding one. The guru is always the wise old man. The guru image is that of the guiding one who can bring you to fulfillment. But your best guru is in yourself. Outside gurus can give you hints and so forth, but you must always carom off the instruction that comes to you from others. And then the total feminine character, he calls the great mother. The anima, it will lead you, finally, to these realizations. The anima becomes the daughter of wisdom. She's leading you to your own fulfillment, and the voice of the wise old man is the interpreter of the world. The image of woman represents the world, as one's mother is one's world. The image of the male is the interpreter of the world, the guide to the world. They have their place. They are together one, two aspects of the one mystery. One can tell you about it, the other is it. One can support it, enforce it, bring it to maturity, the other is it, seeking to be brought to maturity. And that's the way these things work. Now, these are the basic archetypes then. There's the ego, the hero, the golden one. The shadow, the dark, threatening one. The anima, animus, that opposite beloved, who may be dangerous or may be helpful, but if dangerous, will, if followed properly, transform into the guide to wisdom. One good way to wisdom is the way of sin. The voice within is the guiding voice, the wise old guru guide. And then the great mother and the world represents the fulfillment. Now, I was given at the end of the last hour by John Hurley here the tarot pack, and after a little break I want to talk about this a little bit as in relation to these symbolic archetypes of Jung. An awful lot of this can be read that way, but before doing this I want to say that I know nothing about the tarot. I was given this pack only about 4 hours ago, and I've spent the interval in meditation on them with some recollections of some things I've heard about the tarot. And so what I'm going to say is going to be simply my own reading of this, and many of you will know how to correct me, and I ask you to do so, so that we'll get this thing fairly all right. The tarot pack that I have in my hand is, like all tarot packs, divided into five groups of cards. There are four suits, and then there is an honor series of honor cards. Four suits and and honor series. The four suits are wand or rod. Here they call it the pentagram, but the more usual term for the other is coins. And then there's the sword and the cup. Now these correspond to the suits in your normal pack of cards. This would be clubs, would be diamonds. This would be spades. Espada, sword, is mistranslated as spade, and so we have in our pack the spades. And the cup has become hearts. These represent the four estates in the traditional society. The church, the chalice, which of course in the Protestant community, since one's conscience is to be one's guide, becomes the heart. The guidance is shifted when you move from Gothic to Reformation, from the chalice of the Mass to the heart. The sword, as I say, has been mistranslated as spade in our cards, and the sword is the symbol of the aristocratic caste or class. The priestly, the aristocratic. This is the merchant, whether he's dealing in diamonds or in coins. This is the merchant category, and the rod is the club of the churl, of the physical man. Now, in each of these suits, it runs up to the number 10, and then there follows, see these are in the style of the medieval court, there follows the page, the knight, the queen, and the king. This for each suit. So I've briefly talked about the four suits. Now we come to the passage into the higher spheres. Here the interpretation becomes rather arbitrary on my part, let me say intuitive. The first is called the magician. And we see someone able to handle all four elements. He's holding the rod, he has the coin before him, the cup, and the sword. He is the master of the center of the four. So look what we've got. The Jungian four functions, you might say, and the center. This is the master of the center. We're going through the center now into the depth dimension of spiritual experience. And this is our opener of the way, the magician. Sometimes represented as a juggler, actually juggling all four of these. Now, what forms appear are first the female forms. The prophetess, the high priestess, and the empress. The high priestess and the empress. Two anima figures guiding us, and they represent two aspects. One, the spiritual guide, and the other representing spiritual sovereignty. And the empress has guided us to the emperor. So we've come to the wise old man guided by the anima. This fits exactly the Jungian sequence that I've just discussed. You have the female power in its first allure as prophetess, promising, and then in mastery, leading you to or related to the emperor, the lord of all the kingdoms, an emperor rules over kings. He is king of kings. And that's where we've come to in this. This would have to do with the world as we know it. You are in control now of all that. The next card is called the Hierophant. This is the authorized representative of a higher a higher challenge, the challenge of the deeper spirit, what might be called the Grail quest, emerges in your field after you have mastered the world of the four. You now come to a world of spiritual experiences. And the first stage of this is represented in the lovers. The pair of opposites, now experienced in the spiritual sense, united by an angelic form, bringing the pairs of opposites together. You are now to go into great depth on your own, beyond the field of social orders and hierophantic figures and so forth. Now this requires the hero adventure against those tests in the underworld that I spoke of this morning, and this is represented by two heroic figures, one the chariot and the other strength, someone opening the mouth of a lion. These are two stages in this adventure. This is the acquisition of strength, you might say, in Hatha Yoga, preparing yourself for spiritual experiences that only the independently strong can accomplish. And when you are ready for that, there comes the hermit, representing the withdrawing from the whole sphere of what is known into deep, solitary meditation. I feel here at any rate that we're going deeper and deeper. They're like the stages of a passage into abyssal realms. Now following this casting off of all else, we come to two very interesting figures. One is called the Wheel of Fortune. Now the way it's represented here is not the normal way of representing the Wheel of Fortune. The Wheel of Fortune is usually represented as a revolving wheel with a person up here in victory, in triumph, a person here on the way down, the depression, the crack up, the falling stock market, the person down here in the abyss, the person here on the way up. These are the four situations of fortune: falling fortune, the abyss, rising fortune, and triumph. You are not to identify yourself with your fortune. You must know the center, and this is usually held by a goddess, the goddess Fortuna, who is the same as Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune that supports the kings in India. And her character is, if you're on top, look out, you're going to go down. If you're under, you're on the way up. That's the way fortune is, and you mustn't be too greatly stricken by this. And so from here, you're ready for something a little greater than what the world's fortunes can offer. Of course, the hermit is the one who has led you to recognize this. Now, in this particular case, the world of fortune has some signs around it in Latin letters, T-A-R-O, and then T, tarot, as though the tarot pack itself had something to do with this. And then the other signs are the name of God in Hebrew, as though this is the manifestation of God himself. I don't know whether that's characteristic of all tarot cards, but that's what we have on this one. And then, having found that you are dissociated from this, you come into the sphere of divine justice, the knowledge of the balances of the world, and you're beyond the right and wrong and all of that. Now comes what I regard as a very interesting thing. The zodiac has 12 signs. That is the boundary of the world as we know it. The next number 12 is the hung-up man. Now this motif of the hung-up man, hung upside down, has to do with social death. This was a practice in southern France in the time of the formation of this in the 11th and 12th centuries, the person socially punished, instead of being put in the stocks, is hung upside down. And I don't know how many of you saw the photograph of Mussolini after he had been killed, when he and his lover were hung upside down by the Italians, carrying on this old image, this old archetype of the one whom society has rejected. So now you are going to go outside of the bounds of all the values, including that of justice, of which you have any knowledge. Card number 13 is death. 13 is the number in the center of the zodiac. The 12 apostles, Christ, the one to be crucified. The 12 and the 1. 13 is regarded as an unlucky number, also as a lucky number, depending on your orientation. It is an unlucky number if your aim is for success in the world. It is a lucky number if your aim is for spiritual illumination, because it represents the sun door that burns out all of the earthly and sensual. It is the door of the temple, which is guarded by two guardians. You go through that to the higher wisdoms. Now we're in the absolute spiritual sphere. And the next card is called temperance. You have to hold, this is the virtue that is going to carry you through here, temperance. Not going too far in your spiritual zeal and thought for yourself. I might speak at this point of the three temptations of Christ in the desert, the 40 days in the desert, where he imitated in his personal life the 40 years of the Jews in the desert, where the spiritual mission became announced to them. The devil came to him and tempted him in three manners. Temptation one, the devil said, "You are hungry. Why don't you, with your wonderful powers, simply turn these stones into bread?" And Christ, rejecting the economic interpretation of spiritual life, there with Bernard Shaw, said, "Man lives not by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. Go away." The devil next comes and takes him to the top of a mountain and shows him the kingdoms of the world and says, "I will give you these, I will give you political power over these if you will bow to me." And any man who will bow to the devil can have a pretty good political career. And Christ rejects this as well, thus rejecting the economic, political approach to spiritual life. Finally, when you have done that, when you have rejected economics and rejected politics, you may feel pretty light. You may feel pretty spiritual. You may experience what Jung calls inflation. I notice in certain spiritual circles, which I formerly used to be acquainted with, the people walked with rather lofty neck and the eyes just a little above it all, and often they tripped. What did Christ, what was this temptation? So the devil then takes Christ up onto the pinnacle of the temple and he says, "Cast yourself down and God himself will see to it that you don't even hurt your foot." And Christ said, "Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." So don't identify yourself too exuberantly with your spiritual character. Temperance here. But please notice our little figure symbolizing temperance. She is pouring water, the water of spiritual energy, from one cup into another. That's the point of this. We are shifting from the world cup we've just left into the spiritual cup. My kingdom is not of this world. We're going into the other cup. Then what? After inflation, deflation. After feeling like a god, you realize you're not a god. That takes place depression.
And so we come to the dark night of the soul, which it seems to me to be represented in these two figures here, one called the devil and the other the tower. The devil is that dark monster that occludes, that cuts out the image that you have undertaken. You're up here in the fifth chakra now, that you've undertaken to quest for. It's a long ordeal. You're not getting there. Discouragement. The two lovers, the pair of opposites, are bound by a chain. It is as though you were absolutely depressed. Then, the tower. This absolute shattering of the tower of your meditation, the tower of your concern for yourself and all, so that you are no longer concerned for your being, whether you're going to achieve or not achieve. This, of course, the great obstacle in all spiritual life is that you want to be spiritual. And this won't work. It's only when you are absolutely knocked out that something grand happens, and then this happens in three beautiful stages. The star, the heavenly star, the moon, the heavenly moon, and the sun. And when we have the sun, there's the image of the child riding on an animal, on a horse here. You have come to complete fulfillment. Judgment, you are ready now for final victory. Here are the souls of the saved and the blessed rising from their graves when the trumpet of God blows, not the lightning bolt that smashed the tower, but the trumpet for the blessed who survive. And the last card of the series is called the World, and that's our Great Mother again, which I've called the World only a little while ago in Jung's terms. She's the world image as the great female. Now, that's not quite the end. There's one card more, and its name is Zero. It's like the Joker. It's the wandering fool. The one who has gone through it all, has wandered all over the world of the spirit as well as the world of the four functions, you might say, is the master of all, careless of all. The dogs bite him as he goes past, and he wanders about as the royal tramp. This is the last term also in that Zen series, which you've probably seen, of catching the bull. The last is the Tatterdemalion one. And you'll remember also that Ulysses, after he had gone through the entire circle of the Odyssey, comes in as a tramp by the back door. And the suitors who are in the mansion of Penelope and himself have a fake tramp there, too, sitting on the doorstep, who hasn't been through anything. And they think, gee, it'll be fun to see these two tramps go at it, so they sick them on each other. But when they see Odysseus pull up his rags and they see those thighs and those arms, it just begins to be a little bit awesome for them, and he takes that fake tramp and throws them away, and presently is shooting them all to death. This is the way tramps can behave when agitated. Now that's my sort of hit and miss reading of the tarot pack. Thank you for letting me have this. I suppose in the fortune telling, when you put these out, it's almost like a dream. You find out through this where what your present stand is. A little bit like the I Ching, which when you cast it, you find what your situation is now.
The most occult arrangement is the use of what's called the Tree of Life, which is in the same arrangement as a little diagram that's was in a Chinese alchemical text, with the three on top representing the trinity of monad, zodiac, and ego, and then beneath that a quincunx, which is the five, and beneath that then there was two, and they were related from the bottom up respectively to earth, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and then in the top, Saturn, the Zodiac, and the Monad.
Ah.
And so that's the one that's used.
That's related to the Zephyrot of the Kabbalah, is it? No?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the same one.
Yeah. James Joyce plays with on this in, I think it's page 308 of Finnegan's Wake, where where he gives the series down with a whole game on them, and Ensoph is the name of the top one. And he says, Ensoph, that upright one, and that naughty beside him, Zeroine. Beside is spelled B-E-S-I-G-H-E-D. The idea being that when the decade runs out, by joining the one to the zero, we have the possibility of a continuation into 11, 12, 13. So that's the number of the resurrection. Well, since we got on numbers, I thought I'd perhaps give you a little cocktail with a number problem. In dealing with archetypes, there are two orders of archetype. They're the archetypes in mythology that do stem from human nature and might emerge independently in various civilizations. And if you find a cluster of these, it does not follow that we have had a diffusion from one zone to another. But there are certain other types of recurrent motif that can hardly be explained in terms of spontaneous psychological imagery. Jung makes a great deal of the psychological, as all psychologists do. They interpret mythology in psychological terms, and the symbols that occur frequently everywhere they regard as coming from the psyche. But let me speak of one that has interested me for a long time. In India, the idea of the cosmic cycle, the coming and going of the universe, is of what is called a yuga, a mahayuga, a great eon. And this lasts for 4,320,000 years. It falls into four stages, the corresponding to the classical gold, silver, bronze, and iron of declining spiritual energy. The last, called the Kali Yuga, lasts 4,320 years. 432,000 years. 432,000 years. Now, when you turn to the Germanic Eddas and read about Wotan, you find that in his warrior hall, Valhall, there are 540 doors. And at the day of the wolf, the day of the end of the eon, there will go through each of those doors to give battle to the anti-gods. There will go 800 warriors through each door. Years, warriors. Can that number have appeared spontaneously in these two separated areas, Iceland, let's say, and India? Well, that was another of these numbers that sat in my mind for a long, long while. And then I read a translation or description of a work by a Babylonian priest of the 3rd century B.C. named Berossos. And Berossos was talking about the ages of the world in the old Sumero-Babylonian system. The great city of Kish, according to this, was the first city to which kingship came from above, the divine authority installed the first kings in Kish. And there were 10 kings ruling in Kish before the deluge came, which is the counterpart of the end of the world. And these 10 kings ruled for 432,000 years. Now, this was an earlier documentation of this number than either of the other two. It's between the other two, and I take it that the influence went from the Mesopotamian world westward into the German world and eastward into India, because these Indian texts are much later than the 3rd century BC. This represents then an eon. Now, you've all heard of the precession of the equinoxes. You know that every springtime the sun is in a slightly different place on the round of the zodiac when it rises. And the number of years it will take for a completion of this is 25,920 years. The basic Mesopotamian unit, like our decade, was the sos, which is a 60. We still reckon circles in 60s, 60 minutes and all that kind of thing. That's the number of soses in the actual astronomical cycle of an eon. Now, there were 10 kings between the installation of the kingship in Kish and the coming of the deluge. A thought occurred to me. How many patriarchs between Adam and Noah? 10. You know that these numbers and dates in the Bible are all of what is known as the priestly text, which is a 3rd century text following the Babylonian captivity of the Jews. So then I added up to see how many years it would have been. Now, I may not be remembering this number correctly, but I believe it was 1,656 years. I spent about 6 weeks trying to factor that number into this one, and it wouldn't go. Then I thought, well, some German has worked this out. And so I thought, who would that likely be? And I thought of one old gentleman, and I went to his books, and I began to get the sniff of it, and he referred to a paper that had been read at the Scientific Society at Göttingen in 1872 on the meaning of numbers in the Book of Genesis by a very important Jewish archaeologist, Julius Oppert. So I went to this gentleman, and there it was. Now, the Babylonian week was a 5-day week. If you divide 5 into this, you get 86,400. Am I right? Yeah. The number of 7-day weeks in that number of years is 86,400. So what the rabbis were doing was translating this Babylonian system into a 7-day system and hiding their secret, just as the Germans hid the secret in these two numbers. This is a very favorite thing of priestly writers, hiding it so that it is not exoteric, it is not known to everybody. And now we come to a very important theological point. In all of these systems, the flood comes automatically because the world is declining in virtue. The world declines in virtue automatically, and then comes the flood. Whereas in the exoteric reading of the Bible, it says that man became wicked and God in wrath sent the flood. That's a totally different theology. One is the theology of automatic, impersonal round. There is going to be the flood every, 25,920 years. The other says the flood comes when man sins and God gets angry. Both theologies are implicit in the Book of Genesis. And I just leave that as a little theological meditation for anybody who likes to puzzle himself with such things. Yeah?
I've been just looking into numerology a little bit, and I've been adding figures
here that are coming up in those things. Yeah, good. It's always 9. Everyone is 9. That's very important. You see, 9 is the number of temporal change, and it was the end of our decade, and isn't this sneaky, and isn't it fantastic? when you start going on these things, you can hardly believe it. Another number that's implicit in all of this and in the movement of the zodiac is the number 72. That's 512. And you'll be surprised how often that turns up. And it always has to do with this temporal procession. And what's that? That's 9-2. Yeah. Okay, my friends, there are a lot of things that you can worry about if you want to.